Welcome aboard, everyone. This is the Rogue Con Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Rose taking one more day off, and we are so happy to have in studio with us today superstar chef Graham Elliott, one of my favorite chefs, one of my favorite Chicagoans. Thank you for sitting in the studio with us today, Chef.
I am humbled and honored to be here alongside you.
You always have so much going on. I mean, I know you've got television shows like MasterChef, and you know you've got a lot going on out there. Mm-hmm. Talk about what's new with you and what you're working on.
Yeah, so what's really exciting is that we have a new show coming out on ABC that's premiering in June, and it's myself with Aisha Curry and Kat Cora, and it's called Family Food Fight.
Ah.
So it's basically, imagine some of the other cooking shows, but you have families of three, so a mom and her two daughters, husband, wife, and a brother, and they're all cooking against each other, and then the best family is, you know, the best home family cooks in America.
Awesome. When does that debut? In the fall?
June.
And so you've got Top Chef Junior, Master Chef, I mean, and this is, you add this to your...
Yes. So basically, any cooking show with the word chef in it,
it's
like somehow I get to be part of.
We got to get Graham. That's what happens. It's awesome, though. It's a ton of fun.
It's incredible. You know, I started as a dishwasher at age 17 and moved to Chicago at 20 to work for Charlie Trotter. And just to see how things have, you know, snowballed from starting there to not just my own career, but how chefs are, you know, being on TV. No one ever expected or thought of that.
No.
So it's crazy.
Well, I was reading that 4 out of 5 adults say they enjoy cooking programs. And I remember just growing up, there was like Julia Child and Yan Can Cook on Channel 11. And then there was like Mr. Food segments on Channel 7. I don't remember much more than that. I'm sure there were a few more programs. Now there's this explosion. And my 7-year-old watches all these shows.
Right.
7 years old, and all her friends watch the British Bake Off. And
exactly.
These food shows have just taken on for younger generations and all of us.
I mean, food has somehow become entertainment, you know, where people are going out and the first thing they do is take pictures and post them on Instagram, you know, and it's like proving that you're there, spending time editing the photos before they go up, knowing the descriptions and where the pork was raised, you know, and the feelings of the carrot before it was juiced, you know, all these kind of things. It's just insane. But again, you know, for me, I wanted to be able to work with my hands and just have a job. And then you learn that it's this beautiful creative outlet. But again, where it's at now is just crazy. And I thought it was going to be like supermodels in the 80s. Like quick little fad, gone.
Linda,
you know,
Naomi,
Emerald Live,
Cindy.
Doing his bam. Yeah, exactly. All of that. But it's like, here we are 20 years later, you know, the Food Network, and there's a million shows.
Yeah, there's so many. And it's, you know, it's just amazing to see, because I find myself... there's a learning part. There's a travel element, because you're tasting taste from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And that part's really cool, because you get to learn about the countries through their food. But food is such a bonding experience. I know, growing up in a Greek-American English household, both of my dad grew up in the restaurant business, and my mom also worked as a server for many years. And I just, cooking was something we did as a family. And it was like a bonding thing. It was the time when you talk and sort of share, you know, stories. It was a time when, I don't know, there was something therapeutic about it, but also a family sharing moment when I would make, you know, some cookies for the holidays with my mom or whatever. There's that piece of it too.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, throughout history, all the great decisions in life are around a table. You know what I mean? Like all the discussions, everything that's very eye-opening and also soul-satisfying and bonding and bringing everyone together, whether it's friends or family, I think that it's magical. And like you said, being in the kitchen with people that you love, you know, and just seeing them work with their hands and tasting and, you know, putting together some stuff, you know, grandma making the sauce, whatever.
Right.
It's when you get older, you look back on those, and these are moments that make you want to be the same with your kids, you know, and teach them how to do stuff.
Pass along family recipes. My mother-in-law is now teaching my daughter how to make pasta from scratch.
Nice.
Her gabadils, she calls them, and then her gravy, she doesn't call it sauce, you know, the old school Italian stuff from May Street. And so there's, you know, as you just pass on the recipes generation to generation. But the cooking shows, I think, are fueling part of this as well.
Yeah.
This interest in even kids wanting to do it.
Right. The cooking shows for kids are usually ages 8 to 13. And what I've seen is a lot of parents saying, I had no idea, you know, I don't know what celery root is, but my kid does because they watched it on YouTube or some
incredible
other show. So now when we go to the store, I have to buy these things. So now the parents are understanding a lot more about food and, you know, healthy and where it's from and the market and things like that. And I think it's just like, when we were growing up, you had ballet or soccer or gymnastics or piano.
Yeah.
Now food is one of the same things.
Right.
You know, kids are practicing how to bake and
Mommy, cook. Can you buy me the truffle oil when you go to the store?
Yes, exactly.
It's like these high-end ingredients.
Saving your allowance, yeah, to buy some of that.
You also have a restaurant. Well, first of all, I want to ask you, you have three boys.
I do.
Do they cook? Are they taking up after daddy?
The youngest and the middle one do, Jedediah and Conrad. But Milo, the oldest, is not that big of a foodie. You know, he's more into Fortnite. That's his world. But no, the other two definitely like to get in the kitchen.
Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's really great.
And then I want to ask you also about your restaurant in Asia. You've opened up one there. Mm-hmm. What's the theme and what's why Asia?
Yeah, so it's MGM Macau, and mm-hmm. it's called Coast, and it's, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and it's inspired by the region, which isn't only, you know, Southeast Asia, but Portugal, because they had colonized the area first. So there's a tremendous amount of history with that. So, you know, taking inspiration from coastal regions, a lot of seafood, things like that is what's going on over there. Mm. And I lived for 3 years in the Philippines, 6 years in Hawaii. I've been, you know, pretty much throughout Asia and love it. So the opportunity to be over there and do this project was something I had to jump at.
Was that part of your inspiration because you were a military brat and you spent so much time all over the world, but in every state you've been to?
Oh, yeah. Been to every state, all 50, and, you know, 15 schools, including 3 high schools. So I definitely learned that food brings everyone together, but also every single place does the best with what they have. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't usually wake up and say, you know, I feel like eating snails or frog legs. And some people don't say, I feel like having dog, and others don't say, I feel like having, you know, pork rinds and chitlins. You know, it's just, this is what you have.
That's what you have.
This, you know, and I'm trying to do my best. So I'm going to take these greens and cook them for hours with, you know, ham hocks and a little bit of hot sauce. And now they're incredibly delicious. But nobody would want to do that originally if you had another option.
When I was in the South, I got into the crawdads,
thing,
which you didn't really get that much in Chicago growing up here. And then I moved down there, and it was the thing. And they look horrible.
I mean, all shellfish are like gigantic ocean cockroaches.
But these have got a lot more of the brain stuff than the real meat. And I love them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's we got that going for us. We want to take a break here because we're going to come back and ask Lauren Lapka about her experience, just an experience of a lifetime that she had yesterday at White Sox at the rate. Pretty cool stuff. That's coming up. And then we're going to talk to Ben Bradley of WGN TV News. And but right now, let's check in with Kim Gordon, see what's coming up bottom of the hour in the news.
Illinois lawmakers want to make it easier to get booze right to your door.
The White Sox are rolling out the red carpet for the Royals. Expect some fireworks tonight at 7 on WGN TV Sports.
Great radio voice, Chef Graham Elliott. I know you're going to turn it on for those live reads. Really nice. Nicely done. This is the Real Con Show with me, Anna DeBlantis. Chef Graham Elliott was remarking on how we all speak in radio voices, and so he's going to try his out throughout the afternoon
Graham Burgundy.
Today. Very nicely done. Ben Bradley is joining us. He has a broadcaster voice when he wants to. Certainly
I hear the
does.
Chef's voice from Graham. I mean, that's that. You know, he's. Are you screaming? Are you yelling? What are you doing in there?
Yeah, you guys do a lot of yelling, don't you? Chefs generally.
I'm like the Paula Abdul of the kitchen. Like, I'm just like really nice. Like, I love what you tried, and then I'll go tell my sous chef you need to fire that person. I don't like confrontation.
Oh yes. Well, Graham, you probably deal with this in your businesses, but, you know, one of the stories we're keeping an eye on today, you know, involves how you handle misbehaving employees, right?
Yeah, the Inspector General has a report out. We've got some bad actors, apparently.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, the thousands of people work for the city of Chicago. There's going to be a couple of bad apples in the group. And every quarter, the city's Inspector General comes out with a list of investigations that they've concluded. And today's report features the latest edition of city workers behaving badly.
Okay, how bad is badly?
Well, you've got some Office of Emergency Management and Communications dispatchers who decided they wanted to go on a Caribbean cruise together, but they didn't have the vacation time, didn't turn in the request.
Don't let that get in the way.
Instead, they used a Family and Medical Leave Act.
Did they post on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook?
Well, we don't know how the IG found it, but we can tell you the IG says, no, they weren't sick. Nobody in their family was sick. They instead were on this Caribbean cruise, boozing it up. They went horseback riding, rode jet skis, even went on a booze cruise.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Good to be them.
Three of them got fired. A fourth resigned instead of being discharged. And then you've got the story of a Chicago firefighter. who had a City College's student who mm-hmm. was kind of riding along, wanted to see what life was like at a firehouse. The City College's student was aspiring to become a paramedic. Instead, that City College's student, according to the Inspector General's office, was sexually harassed over dinner. There was lewd comments. Oh, there was touching of inappropriate body parts, etc. That firefighter is also no longer with the city. Then you got your typical, you know, parking enforcement aides getting into a fight. You know, part of it caught on camera.
With each
people.
Other? Because usually you get in a fight with the people you're getting tickets
yeah,
to.
Yeah, no, this was a parking enforcement aide working for a city contractor, grabbed and shoved an individual.
Yikes.
Presumably not a fellow parking enforcement officer. This was all witnessed by another parking enforcement officer who didn't report it. And then there's the story of a Chicago Fire Department paramedic who the IG says used excessive force on a patient. The patient apparently was unwilling to consent to treatment. So according to the IG, this paramedic turned the patient's head more than 90 degrees while pinning the patient up against a wall in a use of force that was unsuccessful in the paramedic's attempt to get them to consent to treatment.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What's with all this Inspector General nonsense? I mean, why? What's going on in this city? We've got Lori Lightfoot, who's a reformer and won by such a wide margin. You've got a federal probe exposing what seems to be wrongdoing within our city council to a very large scale, maybe the largest scale we've ever seen. A lot more to come on that topic.
I mean, do you think
sure.
they're trying to get out of their system right now because they know it's coming? This is not the last 5 years.
Before the federal prosecutor takes over on the fifth floor of City Hall? Yeah.
This is January 1st to March 31st. This is not like 2010 to now.
Yeah, it's that's why these are just always the such interesting reads, right? But I was, you know, look, the vast majority of city workers, right, come to work
they're
on
all,
an honest
right.
living, do
mm-hmm.
a good job.
They do.
But as I was saying to Graham, like in any business, right, you always have the knuckleheads.
Always.
I guess, but I think it goes beyond that because I think in the past here, it's been accepted practice in some ways. Maybe if you had extra clout or you had certain security, mm-hmm. you could break more rules than others in other professions and get away with it. And we've seen that certainly in the city history.
Right. And there was a frustration among city workers who, you know, maybe when they saw somebody doing something wrong, sleeping on the job, not showing up, being a ghost payroller, etc., you know, there was a feeling for a long time in some cases, well, gosh, if I can't report this person because they got clout or nothing will be done.
Right.
You know, who comes to mind in that? Ed Burke's son, who has had his own public employment yep. troubles mm-hmm. and apparently was still able successfully to bounce to a cush job in county government. Mm-hmm. And that came out, of course, during the campaign when Toni Preckwinkle really didn't provide a very thorough answer to why she would not check into the employment history of Ed Burke's son. So certainly it appeared as though here you have this clouded alderman. I've heard stories from sources inside city government that said, you know, Burke's son was fond of bragging about his clout and his untouchability in the city.
Yeah, I don't know specifically about that case, but I've heard those cases before, and I know personally about those cases when people would sort of flaunt that mm-hmm. I'm untouchable, you know,
right.
I've got this job, it doesn't matter what I do.
Exactly.
So I can't necessarily say these people that you're reading about fall under that umbrella because this is just bad behavior in general, but I think that it's good to see the Inspector General is being quite active
and
in these matters.
And Joe Ferguson has always done a good job, I think, and that's why I think, you know, his efforts are always greeted with you know, a level of respect because he's always shown himself to be impartial in his investigations, at least as far as I can see. You know, in speaking of aldermen behaving badly, this report actually mentions an alderman, though not by name, saying that the alderman improperly attempted to influence a water department manager's efforts to discipline an employee. So there you have an alderman who's not named in this Inspector General's report, you know, trying to get involved in the water department disciplining an employee for you know, not conducting himself properly. The report says that it didn't actually influence the outcome of that employee's discipline. But, you know, part of the problem, I think, you know, and I was just giving credit to the city inspector general, but let's see some names, right?
Mm-hmm.
This report, which is more than 51 pages long, doesn't name that alderman, for example, doesn't name the city workers. In some cases, journalists are able to piece together either through sources or through lawsuits or other ways who the employees are. But For whatever reason, these Inspector General reports don't often name the people involved. They just refer to them as, you know, City Employee A, City Employee B, etc.
I think there'll be some names coming out pretty soon. Not necessarily from the Inspector General, but the federal probe.
For so long, this has been accepted practice in this city. And why do you think now there's been this tipping point where people are just fed up with it, calling for, you know, changes in city council, for term limits? What's happened?
I think what we're seeing is a seismic shift in the city. Now, I'm not prepared to say that this is, you know, going to lead to some, you know, Pollyanna glory days where everybody in government is clean and good and skipping through fields of sunflowers, all for the good of taxpayers. But I think, you know, you have Ed Burke, you know, losing control of the Finance Committee, which was a source of incredible power.
Right.
In this city.
Alderman Solis, very powerful.
Alderman Solis.
Joe Moore.
Yeah. You know, so you have, you know, the iron grip on power being loosened a little bit. And so more stories come out. Obviously, the feds are doing a massive investigation. I have a feeling we only know the tip of the iceberg in terms of what the feds have found going on with city council. And so... You know, all of a sudden, you don't have anyone named Daly in power. You don't have anyone named, you know, Emanuel in power. People who really relished in the power of the office, Burke, things like that. And you have a new group come in who are more than happy, I think, to expose the bodies that have been buried over the years in the various corners of City Hall.
Yeah. What else coming up tonight on the WGN TV News at 4, 5, 6, 9, and 10?
We're going to go live to Paris, obviously, for the latest update on that awful fire at the cathedral there. We're learning more about what was able to be saved. Also, you may remember about 10 years ago, there was a big fire at Holy Name Cathedral. I remember being out there. It was a brutally cold morning, and they were seeing flames move through the ceiling at Holy Name. Was a sight I'll never forget. Obviously, the damage was not as severe as what we saw in Paris. But still, the cathedral had to be renovated. The roof had to be restored. And I can remember a couple months later going up on scaffolding that had, you know, was set up in the huge cathedral and being able to actually touch the ceiling as we did a story on workers who were renovating and repairing. And our CLTV producer is doing a great job. He's pulled some video now showing some of the interiors of that. And you know, obviously, the repair and reconstruction work is going to be a lot more involved in Paris. But you know, we had a foot of water inside Holy Name Cathedral. We had the ceiling breached by fire, and that beautiful paint on the ceiling and the stained glass, etc. And you go into Holy Name Cathedral these days, and you wouldn't even know.
You wouldn't know it, and you did feel it on a small scale, just how important that is to a community to be able to sort of understand what they're going through at Notre Dame, and they have a big rebuilding process to go. We're going to also weigh in a little bit with ABC News on finding out more about the investigation and what's the latest there. So thank you, Ben Bradley.
Awesome, good to be with you, Anna Graham.
Good to see you.
Cheers.
All right.
Time for the news in... Do we have the news in 2 minutes? And we'll be right back with that. Then we're going to talk to Lauren Lafka about her huge night at the White Sox. Just a really cool thing. We're here with Chef Graham Elliott on The Real Con Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Con Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Chef Graham Elliott is sitting in, superstar chef. You know him, you love him from TV and from Chicago. And we just so happy you're here, Chef Graham. And you are a huge baseball fan as well.
Correct.
You are one of the largest collectors, if not, is there something, you have some status here in the baseball card collecting world?
I am a huge baseball card nerd, yes. So I challenge anyone in the city.
Ooh. Game
to,
on.
To throw down.
All right.
What's your most expensive card?
I cannot say because I know certain people are listening and I'm going to get yelled at.
Give me something, though. Give me something that might make baseball fans perk up and
all
say,
right.
Wow,
1952 Topps Mickey Mantle, number 311.
Wow. Dang.
You can look and see on eBay for a price idea.
Okay. I also know you have a Jackie Robinson card.
I have 8 Jackie Robinson cards.
8.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
So all the tops, as well as 1947 Bond Breads, which is his actual first year.
Gee.
So it was little inserts in packs of loaves of bread. So those are really hard to find. And then I have a signed Jackie Robinson photo that
where,
I have hanging
where
up on the wall.
Do you find all of these?
Auctions, as well as some eBay finds.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it was Jackie Robinson Day at the White Sox yesterday, and our own Lauren Lapka had that childhood dream. Is that fair? Come true yet last night at the ballpark? It was pretty cool, and you were posting the pictures of you there out on the field.
If I knew that was a thing, it would definitely be part of the childhood dream. You know of the first pitch, but I never knew that there was a game ball delivery aspect. If anything, it's better. You don't have to worry with the pressure of throwing a really bad pitch.
Right.
So, yeah, no, it was amazing. I don't know how to explain really the moment aside from I hate smiling, but I was smiling the whole time. So
couldn't help yourself.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. I saw the picture you shared with all of us of you on the Jumbotron, and you were smiling ear to ear for sure.
Yeah.
But I would say, and Chef Graham Elliott, you've thrown out the first pitch before a couple of times. I've thrown out too. I know when you look at yourself on the Jumbotron, most people say that is the most scary moment because you're just like, what am I doing up there?
Where am I?
What's happening? I'm that big and people are going to really watch me. As
the Jumbotron adds like 140 pounds.
Oh, so. No question. But it was cool. You had your family out there, right? Your parents came out as well.
Yeah, my parents and my old next door neighbor who's been a family friend for a very long time. We all got to enjoy it. My dad was actually on the field with me. He got to stand back and watch it happen. So hopefully a proud moment for him. I think he really enjoyed it because, again, he's the reason that we started going to baseball games before I could even remember. I was a very small child. I was probably maybe 5, 4 or 5.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Lifelong Sox fan. And it seems like your dad got you really involved. You went to the Hawks when you were a kid, right? He's been bringing you there for years. Also to the White Sox. I think that's just so cool. It had to be kind of emotional.
It was. It's always been sports, especially Chicago sports, has been a family thing for us for a very long time. So even when I went away to school and I was homesick, I would watch my teams and I'd feel at home because I felt close to family.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. That the WGN, you know, when it was a super station, and I moved away for a few years from my broadcasting career too, I would just watch the Cubs games just to look at the bleachers and to look at the buildings in the back in Wrigleyville, and it made you feel so sentimental about home. The Cubs as well in the game, but it was the atmosphere of that neighborhood that just made you
This is the best sports city in America.
No question.
Down.
Definitely.
Yep.
No question. And you, how did you do with your first pitch, Chef Graham? Are you able to speak of these things?
Yeah. No, I did good. I've done a few. And, I always think that no matter how old I get, one day I'm going to get the call, like, we need you to come pitch tonight. So I'm always trying to practice.
You gotta be ready.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not to talk bad, but especially with the Sox, I'm surprised they didn't just offer you a contract to, like, pitch that night.
Seriously, Lauren, step it up.
Why don't we make this a tryout as well, Lauren? Are you on that?
Exactly.
Yeah, I could use you. Hey, did you hear the violinist who was out there yesterday? The 12-year-old boy.
That kid was amazing.
It was remarkable. I saw it, like, trending during the game, and he was, I think we might have a little piece of it here. He played the national anthem right before the game yesterday.
Wow.
It's Lance Moon. He's a Roseland sixth grader and just a rock star on the violin. He's a baseball player for the White Sox Charities travel team. And I wasn't that aware of this, but it promotes baseball for African-American kids. And so he's on that team. He plays the violin like a rock star. It's pretty cool.
He's no Anna DeVlantis, though. You know, every time we play a clip of a violin, I'm waiting for our night.
Do we have a clip of my horrible playing?
We were out as a show one night, and a violin happened to be present in the restaurant, and Anna's like, back in my day, I played a little violin.
Yeah, don't embarrass me in front of Chef Graham.
Really?
I did do that. We were out.
It was amazing.
It was fun that I did it. It was horrible playing.
No,
I think
it's beautiful, Anna.
It was amazing.
Thank you, Kim. People were cheering for me because it just took a little chutzpah to get up there and do it, right?
Chef Graham, is anybody
anybody ever just played the violin randomly in one of your restaurants?
Well, air violin. You know, you get a couple drinks in and people are just like...
You might want to invite Anna.
Yeah.
I could be a strolling violinist for you. People are into like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
Beautiful.
A mean Mary Had a Little Lamb. I can do that.
At what point of the night does it go from violin to fiddle? Like, when do you start really hitting that? And, like, just letting loose?
Do we have a little bit of... Oh, let's
please
hear it.
Do.
There, just a...
That's amazing.
That was my moment, Chef Graham.
Brings a tear to my eyes.
It does.
It's beautiful.
It does. To think that one day I played in the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra, and that's the only thing I can play to this day. Wasted violin lessons.
I feel you, Anna. I played piano for 15 years.
See?
I can't remember anything.
Thank you, Lauren. People make fun of me like, you never played in the Chicago. I did. But
you guys need to start a band.
Yeah, well, next show outing, Lauren, you're gonna bust out a tune on the piano.
Get on tambourine.
We need a band, Lauren. I think that's a great idea. We just need an auto tune on our band. That's the only problem. But I think I love it. It's still in your heart as an adult because you play it for so many years, and it's just frustrating that you pick it up and you.
Every so often, I'll sit down and slowly start reading through a piece. Because it's not like I can just read and play anymore. It's like, okay, this isn't...
Maybe just a few drinks, just like for Anna when we were out that one night. Next thing you know, it's like, boom! Violins in her hands.
Don't take me anymore.
Tunes.
Strolling violin restaurants, please. It's very dangerous. But it was fun.
Good times.
Keep listening after 4 o'clock for your chance to win a pair of tickets to Weather Day, presented by WGN-TV. It's Tuesday, May 14th, Chicago White Sox versus Cleveland Indians, 110 game. Prior to the game, join Chief Meteorologist Tom Skilling. We'll be talking to him later in the program in the 4 o'clock hour for a fun-filled weather presentation that includes videos, trivia, White Sox mascot, Southpaw, and much more. Get tickets at whitesox.com or call 866-SOX-GAME. That's coming up, your chance to win. We're going to take a break here, find out what's coming up at the top of the hour news, and then we're going to talk to Tom Rivers of ABC News, get the very latest on the investigation and the efforts to rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral coming up. But first, here's Kim Gordon.
It's tax day is come and gone, but will the IRS turn over the president's taxes to a House committee next week?
Le peuple de France, je voudrais dire que nous partageons la douleur aujourd'hui que la cathédrale de Notre Dame, c'était comme un cadeau à l'espèce humaine. Et nous partageons la douleur, mais aussi nous vous remercions de ce cadeau à la civilisation.
Now, you might think that that's President Emmanuel Macron. It is not. It's the South Bend mayor, Pete Buttigieg. I can never say his name right, but you know what I'm talking about. Did you hear his French, Chef Graham Elliott?
I did. It's pretty incredible.
I mean,
he speaks six languages.
Yeah, and plays the piano. I mean, he was
playing that in the background as he was talking. That.
We've got a lot to talk about. Notre Dame, we want to get the very latest. Yesterday at this time of the day, boy, things looked so grim. We heard from the official spokesperson at Notre Dame saying everything is burning. There was such sadness. And maybe some reasons for hope today. They will rebuild. The President Macron did address the French people and the world today, saying just that we will rebuild as beautiful as it was before. Tom Rivers from ABC News is joining us now with the very latest from Paris. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you? Yeah, you're absolutely right. Go back about 26 hours ago, it did not look good. And I think a lot of us were watching it. I was watching it from the foreign desk in London at that time, thinking to myself, boy, they're going to just have to level this and put something else there. But at first light, they got the experts in there. After 9 hours of battling the flames, the firefighters did their job. They got them in there, checked it out, and they said, look, parts of this are going to be okay. It can be strengthened, rebuilt, new parts put in as well, a new roof, a new spire, some of the new glass in some of the areas like the stained glass is going to have to be replaced. Some of it can still remain, but it's going to be a work in progress and something that should take maybe a decade or two, according to experts. Macron says he wants it done in 5 years. That's incredibly fast.
It is. You have seen, though, a number of prominent wealthy French families come forward to pledge millions of dollars. Bernard Arnault, you've got Henri Pinault, who is Mr. Selma Hayek, they're pledging hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Last I heard is, what are we at now? I mean, in terms of just what they've raised overnight to try to rebuild.
I think that you check the wires every hour. I think they're up to around 700, 800 million in total for the coffers. For that's one day. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's pretty amazing. The money should, in theory, be there. They're going to have to roll up their sleeves and get people with certain skills that don't grow on trees. How do you put up a medieval buttress or make one that looks like it did back then? How did they make it back then? It's not easy, but they'll get there in the end, but it's going to be a long, laborious process, and it's going to cost money, but it looks like that part of the equation is going to be sorted out.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good to hear. I heard there were 52 acres of ancient oak trees that were cut down, huge trees, and just from a construction perspective, they were not cut. These were entire trees that they had used in some places to construct that roof that we saw tragically burn, and you wonder, well, what do you do right now? But you know what was encouraging? Just to see that the shell, and they say it's structurally sound, and that those towers were preserved, and that there's so much there that you weren't sure about, yesterday.
Oh, no. It looked really terrible in the middle of the night. And the flames, I guess, deceiving, but... Yeah, it looked pretty bad, but by the light of day and getting the right experts there, they say, look, some things are intact. One tower is in good shape. The other one, mm-hmm. going to need some work, but they say it's going to be strengthened. It will be all right.
Mm-hmm.
But other aspects, you're going to have to start over and make it look like the real thing, I guess.
Right. And there's the story of this hero fire brigade chaplain, just an incredible story about he's the one who many witnesses say saved the crown of thorns, the one they believe Jesus Christ worn on the crucifix, also the cross, like the cross that Jesus was nailed to. According to what we're hearing from the cathedral and the spokespeople from there, he rushed in to save those in priceless relics.
Exactly. He and others, he obviously knew what he was looking for, but others were there and they picked up things, literally something that they could pick up, and they formed a human chain and took it out of the cathedral, walked it not too many yards away into the city hall there, and that's where it resides tonight. And it's interesting, we had the culture minister talking this morning here in Paris, and he said basically, if they had waited 15 minutes and said, let's see how things develop and let's just kind of lay back, he said all of that stuff would have been totally, totally gone.
Oh, just incredible to think about that. What about the investigation, Tom? What can you tell us there? There's been a lot of speculation, and we'd like to bust out some of that a little bit and tell us what we know right now and what we don't know.
Yeah, going back to last night, fire officials were saying it looks like it came from the restoration work. This morning, the chief prosecutor in Paris held a briefing, and he said basically the same thing, fleshed it out a little bit, said that he rules out arson. He says it doesn't look like arson, doesn't look like crime, not criminal activity, doesn't look like terrorism. He says it looks like a quote-unquote accident, and we'll have to learn more about that. Was it a spark from, they were doing some welding at the base of the spire. Could that have fallen down into some of these 160-year-old timbers that were there? It, possible, yes. Could have been something that overheated, some electrical frayed wire. Fill in the blank, but it was something of that nature. That's what they think it is at this stage. They're going to try to get more detail on it in the coming weeks, months, but it may end up as a dead end and just saying, look, it's something that happened up there and we can't really nail it down, but that's as far as we can go.
Yeah. Tom Rivers, we appreciate it so much. Tom Rivers, ABC News, reporting to us from Paris on Notre Dame. We appreciate it. Thank you, Tom. Coming up, the stories that matter from Kim Gordon and the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. That's coming up in 2 minutes. It's The Ro Khan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Ro is back tomorrow. Chef Graham Elliott, superstar chef. You know him, you love him. He's sitting in studio with us today, and we're so happy you're here, Chef Graham.
Thank you.
Lots to talk about. Do you know Tom Skilling? You ever met Tom Skilling?
Absolutely.
We love Tom Skilling,
too. He's like
too.
Everyone's uncle in the city.
We just feel happy that he's here, yes. And we turn to him in times of lots of need. So and now is a time of need for us. Actually, because it's, well, we got over a little snowstorm, and now it's all looking not so bad.
Hey, do you know something? An interesting stat, Anna. And by the way, Chef Graham, hello.
How are you, sir?
Very well. Happy, what is this, Tuesday?
Post-snow day? Post-April snow?
Hey, this is an interesting stat. Yeah. Bill Snyder, when Bill's eyes are glowing when he comes in, he says, I've got the ultimate factlet here. He and Steve Kahn have put their heads together and they've combed the records. This is the fastest or the greatest temperature bounce back from after a major snow in the Chicago history. Never have we gone from 3 inches or more of snow to 70-degree temperatures in 48 hours. And we have records going back on this 134 years. So, boy, you know, our bodies have got to be saying, what in the world is going on here?
And your mind, because I walked out today, and I was going to walk the dog, and I wore my puffy coat. And I just, like, I just have to, because I was cold, I was freezing the other day. So now today, I've got to have that on, and then you felt a little embarrassed.
It's amazing. Now we're going to the other end of the spectrum, because we've got one of these backdoor fronts coming through. So the temps in the next couple of hours are going to crash. We'll be down to the 40s on the shoreline at downtown, and that'll be working inland. And we'll probably start the day in the upper 30s or low 40s tomorrow and maybe have a shower or thunderstorm. We're hopeful, though, that this front that's passing through and turning the winds off the lake and, you know, kissing our warm weather goodbye will turn around, go back north, and that we could be back in the 70s over a chunk of the area by later in the day tomorrow. But that could brew some new thunderstorms tomorrow night. But you got to love April. I mean, with a cold lake sitting next to us, these temps kind of bobble around. You almost need a scorecard to keep up with.
Is this a meteorologist's dream? You know, just like, God, if only one day it could, like, snow and then turn to 70, like...
Chef, we're crazy.
I can just imagine you, like, in Santa Barbara with this job, just, like pre-recording everything, like, it's about 72. Chance of some cloud, and then, like, you just go on vacation for 6 months.
I have a friend, true story, is a weatherman who got in big trouble for doing just that. He pre-recorded a segment, and then there was a major storm system that moved in unexpected after a week of very, very nice, consistent weather. So it does happen.
It does. Somebody once asked me, a news consultant said, would you consider going out to the West Coast? I said, absolutely. Positively not. But you know, back in those days, we didn't have the modeling. There actually is some very interesting weather out there. It's all on a kind of a mesoscale, because I worked with an anchor when I was down in Jacksonville, Florida, who had come from Fresno, California. And he always said, the weather out here in Fresno is amazing, because you can get in a car and drive to the beach one way, and then you drive up in the mountains, and each place you get a different weather regime. And there is some truth to that. And our models, you know, in the early years, didn't have the kind of resolution that could handle these little microclimates. But they do now, and so it'd be a different world. But I still find the Midwest weather eminently more interesting.
Man, I would, you know how baseball has been taken over by analytics?
Yeah.
You know, I would love to see the same happen in your line of work, where, like, your worth on the street is based on your average, your batting average. Like, how much rain did you call for, and what really happened this year?
Well, you know something? There was a book written by Matt Silver of
538 fame.
538
predicts politics, and he actually helped me out with my NCAA bracket this
year,
and I won the pool.
I
used his research. Tom, true story.
Cheating.
He is the ultimate statistician, and he wrote a book that went on to the New York Times bestseller list called The Signal in the Noise, Why Most Forecasts Fail, But Some Don't. And he was talking about, he looked at 16 different fields in the weather forecast, like economic predictions, earthquake predictions, at which there's no skill. It just run down the list. He found none of them are political forecasts. There wasn't any discernible improvement, but the one area he said there was improvement was in weather forecasting, and that was quite interesting. And it really is true. We've come a long way. We're not perfect. We're dealing with a complicated system, but we're hitting a lot more than we used to.
And how much of that is based on science versus predictions of just like, this is what I feel today.
Or technology, yeah. Right? Isn't it?
Guys, it's Newtonian physics, honestly. Yeah. You know, these supercomputers that do quadrillion operations per second to generate these forecasts are running, you know, fluid dynamics equations is what it amounts to. And this is taking it from the realm of the art into the science. And that's a big change in meteorology.
Yeah.
How many days can you actually predict, do you think?
You know what? It varies on the weather pattern. We have 60% skill scores out to day 7. Wow. But certain features of the atmosphere, we can forecast out to, you know, 3 weeks ahead of time with discernible accuracy, like the general upper air pattern. And general patterns, we can, you know, forecast out years in advance, or at least with some degree of skill, like basic upper air patterns. We couldn't tell you when a specific snowstorm was going to hit in that time range. But we can within the first week or two with some degree of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, great accuracy.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I just want to mention that you're sponsored by PermaSeal. I was supposed to get that in earlier, but go ahead, Graham. I'm sorry I didn't get it in on time.
I was going
to
say, hopefully you'd be able to see local governments be able to plan accordingly.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you've seen that, obviously, you know, with hurricanes.
Tsunamis.
That's what we hear about.
Great
yeah.
improvements there.
But just in general of the storms coming, you know, we need to set up for A, B, and C.
Right.
Well, you know,
Save lives.
It's critical in our coastal areas because it takes at least 3 days to evacuate our coastlines anymore because the roads go into gridlock and everything else. And so you've got to give folks in Florida or down in, you know, the Gulf Coast area, 3 days notice for all of them to get out. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's ever gone through that evacuation process will tell you what a horror
brutal.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
Because the roads go into gridlock. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, we have skill out in the range of 5 to 7 days on these storms many times.
Mm-hmm.
Can't tell you precisely where to landfall, but we sure can identify the general region. Mm-hmm. You know what else has been interesting here in Chicago is I've gotten a kick out of our ball teams and the way they're putting weather forecasts to use. Just in the last week, the White Sox called off the opening game and delayed it a day because it was going to rain and be cold.
Mm-hmm.
And they saved, you know, the fans coming into town and putting up with this horrible weather and waited a day and it was fine, you know. And I think that's kind of interesting.
But didn't the Cubs play?
Yeah, the Cubs started early, you know, based on a weather forecast that said the weather is going to go downhill.
Well, mm-hmm. We just saw that with the Masters, too. They started the Masters ridiculously early.
Mm-hmm. And look at our airlines. You know, I mean, you know, they call off these flights because nothing's worse than getting out to the airport and having to wait, you know, for 12 hours.
Or getting on the plane and sitting on a tarmac.
That's
and dealing with the repercussions of angry customers.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
And pretzels.
I mean, restaurants do the same kind of thing. And what we used to do, even at Charlie Trotter's, was when we had that massive snowstorm at the end of 98, beginning of 99, you had 150 people on the books and only like 15 or 20 showed up. And they all got like a 20-course menu because it was like rewarding
that.
So it's, you know, we're going to do all this extra stuff and change your life tonight because you came in.
And I'm sure, Chef Graham, you will confirm this. I know for many years the restaurant folks were mad at us because they said, you know, you kill our industry, or you put out a storm watch and the storm doesn't show up and you kill our business. And there's, you know, that's a legitimate concern.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a great deal of work done to try and get rid of these false alarms, you know. And so when we come out with a storm warning, the idea now is to, you know, really have our modeling has gotten better, so we do a better job hitting those things than we used to.
The polar vortex, remember, you couldn't find a restaurant or a delivery service, and I get why.
Yeah.
You don't want people to come out in brutal, dangerously cold temperatures, but it was interesting to see. That
it's true.
There was a list, I think, I saw published in the Tribune or somewhere, the only restaurants we could find that are open during the polar vortex.
Yeah.
So few did.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so cool about this city, though. Chicago and, you know, just feel so much stronger for getting through that.
Totally.
You know, that when when you see people in LA wearing you know, parka because it's 62 out, and
Ugg boots,
roll your eyes
when
you're
it's
like,
45.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
You're absolutely right. It's like a matter of civic pride.
It's total pride. Yeah, because I think when
you
can do the forecast, it's like it's negative 20, negative 10, and then just hashtag deal with it.
Yeah.
Like it's Chicago.
Chef, I'll tell you, you are in a fascinating line of work, and we are so lucky in this city to have such marvelous culinary fair.
Isn't it true?
You know, it's just amazing. By the way, you know, I've always the word culinary, I always say culinary, but
it, what is it? Can you settle that
culinary
for us, Chef Graham Elliott? Is it culinary or culinary?
I think I always say culinary.
Culinary.
Culinary sounds kind of like those that say niche versus niche. You know, it depends on what group of friends you're around.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, these pronunciations. I remember I worked in Jacksonville, Florida for a year, and we used to have a producer down there who said it's Caribbean, it's not Caribbean. And he and it's the leeward side of the island, not the leeward side. And he'd get into these terms that you use down there in the hurricane belt. But I was down in the Caribbean, and I said to folks, now, do you have a preference, Caribbean versus Caribbean? And you like to hear from people on the ground because they know, you know, they live there. And so I wanted to talk to somebody in the restaurant industry, in the culinary business, to find out what...
Right, how to say it, because I've struggled with that one too, and right. it's but you know what's cool? It kind of speaks to our chefs. We've got celebrity, rock star, nationally world acclaimed chefs in this city. We are so blessed, we're so lucky, and yet most of the ones I know, and I know quite a few of them, mm-hmm. like Chef Graham, are just down to earth people who want you to love their food and their restaurant, and it's so cool. It's such a great. It's not snobbery. Doesn't really play well in Chicago.
No. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say what's amazing is that if you look at other cities, San Fran, New York, people will work there and then they go off to somewhere else. Chicago, more than any place that I've ever seen in the country, people will work at a restaurant and then leave and then open their own here. Or, you know what I mean? Like, everybody that's here has done it organically because Chicago embraces their own more than anywhere else.
You know what else, Chef, is it's amazing the work you and your fellow chefs do. There was a Meals and Wheels mm-hmm. fundraiser where you invite people in for a meal and on raise money for mm-hmm. Meals on Wheels and other charitable events like that. And our, you know, folks in your profession give and give and give, and it's really amazing. And you all work so hard, long hours,
right?
And,
weekends, nights, holidays. Oh, it's
it's mm-hmm. a challenging career. And yet there's such passion toward what you do
among
your peers.
Think of it that you can meet a farmer that puts all their love into, like, you know, raising an animal or putting something into the ground and then harvesting it, dusting off the dirt, and we get to take it and cook it and serve it to people tell them the story, and they smile. Like, I can't believe, like I said, that I can pay bills doing this. Like, I would do it for free anyway. Because
that's
the coolest thing
so
in the world.
Cool.
I know.
You know,
really
working
is.
With this stuff.
That
really
is so cool. And you probably feel the same too, Tom.
I do.
I mean,
we're all blessed.
Yeah.
Yes.
We love, and you
mm-hmm.
too, Anna.
Yes.
You know?
Seriously, you think about just getting to be a broadcaster in this town where mm-hmm. there's just some of the greatest people ever have come through the doors of all these institutions, and it's just we're lucky. Very lucky
people.
We are
very lucky, yes.
Tom, we probably got to get going, so tell us what we can expect tonight, tomorrow.
Big temp drop tonight, and it'll be chilly and raw tomorrow with a wind off the lake until later in the day. We're hoping this front will come north and reintroduce the warmth, and then within that warm air, we'll get some thunderstorms tomorrow night. There may be a few, though, toward morning and during the morning hours. They'll be scattered, but don't be surprised, despite the chill, because there's some warmth aloft and instability up there that could pop a couple showers and storms. But most of them will be tomorrow night, and we'll watch that and then see a couple of showers Thursday. It'll turn windy and be chilly on Friday, but the Easter weekend is looking gorgeous. Easter Sunday itself may be up in the 70s around here. So.
All right.
How about that?
Sounds terrific.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom. We appreciate it.
Anna, good to talk to you. Good to talk to you, Chef. And
you
guys
as well,
have
sir.
A great one.
You too. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
All right. Coming up, we're going to be talking to Northwestern Medicine, Dr. Jim Adams, about the measles cases surging in 20% in 1 week here in the United States. That and more medical news. Dr. Jim Adams, Chief Medical Officer and SVP, the Senior Vice President of Northwestern Medicine, is waiting in the PPG Paints Green Room right now. And after Kim's news, he'll tell us why measles is on the rise and what we can do about it. Also, a chance to win. Keep listening for your chance to win tickets to see Tom Skilling in concert. We'll explain. He's listening to that potentially. I'm wondering what we're talking about, but it is. It's real, and it's coming up after we hear from Kim Gordon. See what's coming up in the news on the bottom of the hour.
And a lawsuit's being filed to try and stop the Lincoln Yards project on the north side.
All right, right now, be caller number 19, 312-981-7200. Win a pair of tickets to Weather Day. This is Cool Weather Day, presented by WGN-TV. Tuesday, May 14th, before the Chicago White Sox take on Cleveland Indians. This is a cool event. Prior to the game, join Chief Meteorologist Tom Skilling. Fun-filled weather presentation, including videos, trivia, White Sox mascot, Southpaw, so much more. It is a fun day at the ballpark. Get tickets at WhiteSox.com or call 866-SOX-GAME, S-O-X-G-A-M-E. Good luck. All right, it's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Chef Graham Elliott is in this afternoon, and we are going to be talking to the chief medical officer at Northwestern Medicine, some health news, including the latest on the measles situation. A lot to talk about there, but we've got Kim Gordon's news in 2 minutes. It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. We have Chef Graham Elliott sitting in with us today here in studio. As Ro's going to be back tomorrow, but he's off today. This segment is sponsored by Northwestern Medicine. The pursuit of better health care starts here. And our guest is Dr. Jim Adams, the Chief Medical Officer, Senior Vice President at Northwestern Medicine. Hi, Dr. Jim. We have a lot to talk about today because the measles story is everywhere. When we talked with you last, it was a concern, and now concerns are growing even further. I know there's a cluster in New York that particularly health officials have an eye on right now.
Yeah, it's a very disappointing story. Measles in the United States was declared eliminated in the year 2000. Mm. We thought it was a success, but now already in 2019, the United States has had 555 cases. And it's so discouraging to see this come back.
Seems like a small number, but it seems when I hear from health professionals, there is a degree of strong concern. You see this in New York, where you saw the mandatory vaccine order given, and now you have a lawsuit from some New York parents mm-hmm. who don't want to give that vaccine. And there's even one school, small school, they shut down because they wouldn't willingly give up their medical records to show who's vaccinated. So there's a lot of pushback from certain communities. In this case, I think it's religious communities mm-hmm. who don't believe in vaccinations. But it's that's the way New York's dealing with it. The vaccine is 97% effective, so it certainly helps.
We've had a vaccine for 50 years used safely, but measles today, because it's not available everywhere, measles kills almost 90,000 children every year. Mm. It's one of the leading worldwide causes of death of children under five. It's one the leading vaccine preventable cause of death in children worldwide. It is nothing to mess around with. Mm-hmm. So to have a safe vaccine is disappointing. And the more worrisome thing is there's so much misinformation right. out there, yeah. and that's what hurts.
I mean, I think that that's what you've been seeing with, you know, saying autism is related to vaccines. The minute that that came out, so many people are like, I'm just not going to vaccinate my kids. It's come out and been disproven, right?
We used the measles vaccine in the 1960s. Right. We used it in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. We used it in the 1980s. We've had it for half a century. This is just a new conversation. It just hurts.
Yeah. Symptoms, though, that's the hard part because you can be exposed to it even before, is that right, before you start to show real symptoms? One of the issues?
Well, it takes a week to two to develop the symptoms, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. then it starts with a high fever, and that's where then the contagiousness hits.
So what would you look for as a parent? Not that we have some cases here in the Chicago area, don't we? Aren't there some in the suburbs?
We do.
Talk about what we're seeing here locally.
Well, it's rare, and but we expect to see it because of O'Hare and international travelers, so we mm-hmm. expect it to be in the environment. Now, fortunately, most people are vaccinated, but there's some pockets that are not, and it does show up. But when I was taught, and I was just in the area where measles was being eradicated, but still rarely around, I was taught that it was a high temperature, 104, big mm-hmm. temperature, and the child looks measly. It was really interesting.
Measly?
Measly.
What does that mean?
Yeah, red eyes, they're tired, they're coughing, they're just miserable looking. It's just this miserable appearance, and then the rash breaks out about 3 days after the temperature. So it takes a while for this to incubate, but they're highly contagious. And measles is one of the rare viruses that spreads through the air. That's the real danger.
So explain that. You say it's highly contagious. You could just be in the same room like you and I are talking 4 feet away and I could get the measles?
That's the danger, yes. If you're just in the environment and it's a virus that hangs in the air and it's one of the most highly contagious viruses. Almost every virus you pick up from a surface, this you can pick up from the air and it's highly contagious. Mm. You see why we're afraid.
Right. Yeah. And as you were saying, most of this generation, past generations have been vaccinated, but if the current one or current kids are not getting it and it's going around, they're the ones that are going to be most susceptible.
Yep.
Right? And it's horrible.
And there's people on chemotherapy who have a weak immune system, mm-hmm. who are very, very young children who are not old enough to get the vaccine, and or chronically ill people. And so these are the people that can be truly harmed by the measles.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. That's very sad. That's the reason alone to get the vaccination, just to protect those kids that really need your help. Can I ask you about shingles as well? Because it seems like, just anecdotally, even asking around the office here, people younger and younger we know of are getting the shingles. It was once associated with someone who was quite elderly and maybe immunodepressed, and now you hear more cases of this happening. Is that what you're seeing as well, doctor?
Sure. People who've had the virus, it stays in the nerve endings, and then under stress, it can break out. So we see it a lot of us with associated stress. People might be traveling and get jet lagged. They may be overworked, under stress for any reasons, and it breaks out. So it does happen, but it's time limited. Usually, you feel some tingling in advance. You can get medicines to help temper
a little bit of pain. As soon as it starts to present, you can get the antivirals, I guess, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Also, we want to ask you about added sugars. There's this push, and you've seen some articles out about trying to get the FDA to label packaging. And obviously, there's a push behind this to put it on the packages, you know, make the food companies explain how many grams of added sugar you have. And you might think that then the food companies would say, well, we're going to try to reduce the amount of sugar. Then there's sort of that might be what's behind this campaign, because if you have to put it on the box, they might be encouraged, disincentivized to add it. But in terms of how dangerous they are, added sugars in our diet, and why we should watch out for them, speak to that issue a little bit for us.
Yeah, so the best thing is to eat natural foods, the natural vegetables, the natural fruits, the natural grains, the natural seeds. And that's the best way to approach it. The highly processed foods of any sort are proving to be surprisingly bad for us. And so the added sugars, but added and processed foods of any sort are kind of bad. Teasing out, is it just the sugar? I don't know. Labeling, always good. I think people, more information is better, but it gets complicated. It really gets complicated.
Well, it's like fructose, dextrose, lactose. I mean, I go through the labels myself. I will admit, when I go to the store, I even have a trouble finding a bread that doesn't have one of those when I'm making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or whatever for lunchtime. And I feel like it's added into everything.
Well, I remember two years ago, you know, the industries were trying to change it from corn syrup to corn sugar. And it's one of those things that you've heard for 2 decades now, corn syrup's bad. So if you see corn sugar, a lot of people might just say,
that's fine. That sounds fine.
Right. So I think it is one of those things where you look at a label and you're told to look at it. You still have no, it's like reading Russian. Like, you have no clue what any of these things, right? Niacin, riboflavin.
Right.
No one knows what that stuff is.
Are those good for you, doctor? The niacins and the riboflavins?
They are. They're good vitamins, general vitamins. But the trick, just look for the thing with the highest fiber. If you're looking for bread, just look for fiber. Take the one with the highest fiber. Always take the one with the
highest
fiber. Pro
tip. That's going to change my buying tactics now. That really changes everything. So sugars in general, moderation is good, obviously. Should we be pretty worried about them? Should we watch them in our diet in terms of being high level sensitive to them?
Yeah, but it gets too confusing. There's not one thing to watch. I think skew to the healthy, skew to the fiber. You'll be fine. Skew to the low processed. And don't get hung up on any one thing, because the fads and the narrative change fat sugars.
That's true.
Dr. Jim's in bed with big fiber.
I like that. I think we all should be. It sounds horrible. I'm not getting enough, I'm
horrible
sure.
Industry.
As a chef, do you guys, I mean, you know, do you think about sugar content?
I think that I don't even want to say everything in moderation, because we look at sugar the way that you look at salt, and we also look at acids the same, right? It extracts flavor. It makes something taste more like itself. But I 1000% agree that the more hands that get in the middle of something, the worse it is, right? Like processed. I always think, if you really want potato chips, like, make them yourself. You know, if you just get a great potato, shave it paper thin, bake it off, season it with some herbs and sea salt, great, you know. But clearly more convenient to grab a bag and open it up. But if you really did look at what was in it, how many grams of fat or sodium,
preservatives, I mean,
there's a reason, you know, that people are the size that they are.
The obesity epidemic.
Absolutely. And you don't want to call people out, but really, when you think of convenience, eating in your car, eating late, grabbing these things that are tasty because they're loaded with sugar, salt, and fat.
Right.
It's a no-brainer.
It is. What's changed my life is an air fryer, because now I put vegetables in the air fryer, and everyone in my family will eat vegetables now because they're crispy and they taste like potato chips. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, that's just what we've done to try to get everybody to eat more vegetables. We also ask you to weigh in, Dr. Jim, about the, there was this groundbreaking medical news this week about the world's first 3D printer generated heart. And it seems like such a remarkable thing. I guess it doesn't actually work in the person's body, but this is still groundbreaking.
So it is. There's a lot of engineering marvels going on in artificial organs broadly. This artificially developed heart, because there's a shortage of organs and people need organs and there's always going to be a shortage. And people are trying to manufacture artificial kidneys and artificial livers, finding the scaffolding to populate cells, or in this case of heart, do 3D printing. So it's fascinating, very, very early. But in our lifetime, we could see manufactured artificial organs that actually work.
Mm-hmm. So they use the patient's own cells for this. It feels like this is something, how close to being something that you could implant into somebody? How far away would you say we are from having a functional printed heart? It just seems weird to even say that.
Yeah, we're many years, but using the patient's own cells means they won't reject it. So that's a huge advance on the rejection front. But then we have to make sure that it's safe and effective. It's got a long way to go before we could test it and make sure it's safe. It's mm-hmm. got a long, long way to go. But each one of these steps are exciting.
You were saying in the culinary world, you see them working with this kind of science.
Right, absolutely. And trying to, you know, grow meat in a lab, because the idea that, you know, raising cattle, it takes millions of acres, and now people all around the world have more access to funds to buy those type of items. So, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't have longevity. It's not self-sustaining. Same thing with seafood, right?
I mean,
think of how many tuna rolls are served just in this city times the world over.
Like, right.
They're not going to be around very much longer. So are you going to be growing these type of things, you know? And I was going to ask you, doctor, when you get into the world of medicine, right? You're like, I'm going to go to med school, and there's a lot of different reasons. I want to make people healthy. I want my dad to love me. Like, whatever, you know, all these different things. Why am I going to get into this line of work? And did you ever think, like, you'd be talking about hearts being 3D printed? Because I never thought as a chef I'd be talking about meat getting grown in a lab.
No.
When I started.
Couldn't have imagined.
So could not have imagined it. I was training at the time where heart surgery was still coming into the forefront at mm-hmm. all. And that was shocking and amazing. To think where we are now is just inconceivable.
Right.
Yeah.
Same thing in the food world. I mean, talking about, you know, being able to grill, sear, and roast, and now things are sous vide, you know, mm-hmm. where they're perfect temperature.
And I don't even know what that is, but I like
so,
when it's
done. I mean,
done.
You basically, yeah, you cook it under a vacuum, so it's sealed, and none of the flavor can get out, and then you poach it in water, so that you could cook a short rib at 220 for 8 days, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like, it would be fork tender, versus back in the last 500 years, you would have to put it under like a little piece of parchment paper and let it simmer and hope that it, you know, came out right. So
breakthroughs all around.
Temperature, yeah. But I mean, I never in a million years thought that I would be doing that kind of stuff.
All right, we got medicine and cooking. We got the perfect blend here today, and we appreciate you, Dr. Jim Adams, Senior Vice President, Chief Medical Officer at Northwestern Medicine. Thank you so much. We covered a lot of bases today, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have Kim's News coming up, and we want to check out what's happening at the top of the hour here in Kim Gordon's News right now. Thank you.
Anna, a new theater experience coming to Chicago this summer.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Kim Gordon from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. It is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Chef Graham Elliott is here with us, and we're so happy you're joining us today. Rose back tomorrow. You are among the many, many things you do. You have the Master Chef, the Top Chef, the Master Chef Junior. You've got a new show, a food fight show.
Yes.
Family
Food Fight on ABC. So it's Aisha Curry, Kat Cora, and myself, and it's families cooking against each other. So.
Do they actually get in food fights, do you think?
No, not fist fights, but I mean, sometimes they might throw stuff at each other. But I mean, you have a family, you know, with a mom and her two daughters, a husband, wife, and a kid, and you know, you have a Korean background, a Latin background, Mediterranean, like all the different groups
of people.
Or
are they cooking their specialties?
Yes. Yeah, so you see the cross-section of food in this country right now. So hopefully it'll be very eye-opening to people.
We watch a lot of cooking shows in our family. We all love it, and I love it too. I love cooking. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I feel so stressful the way you have those clocks on people, and they're like, they're sweating, and they're trying to get meet the deadlines and do all of this. They're so enjoyable, though. It's got to be so much fun to work on.
It's super fun, but it is stressful because I, maybe not everybody, but want everyone to win, and I want them to do well. And if they go home, I still want them to cook. So it's like, you have 10 minutes left, and I realize that they don't have a pan on yet, and it's not hot. And I'm please, throw the chicken in first. You know, you can chop the herbs at the end. Like,
can you give them advice in this new
not
one?
Really.
No, you're not allowed to. Like, you're just like biting your nails. Like,
in the back. Yes.
They're not going to do it. They're not
exactly.
going to do it.
Like,
is it like that in a kitchen, in restaurants? I mean, does it get like that? I know you worked for Charlie Trotter, and he was notoriously demanding, and because of that, produced some of the best chefs in the world who came up through his program of working for him.
I feel like you'll eventually get it. You know, like if you're in charge of certain dishes, you know that this one has to be cooking while this is going on. You know, the last thing you want is to have a four top, someone ordered the salmon, one ordered the chicken, one ordered a veg dish, and one ordered the steak, and everything's ready, but the steak wasn't put on the grill yet. Because now you have to remake all those other three items.
Otherwise they're cold.
Yes. Or they overcook, or they dry out in the window. So it's like everything is timing. So when you call a ticket in, somebody has to start grilling, somebody has to start searing.
But they cook at different times. That would be so...
Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
That's why it gets... And imagine that four top times, 100. So you got like a couple hundred people in tonight, and the poor person on one station is getting slammed. You know, it's Friday during Lent. I can't eat meat, so the poor fish guy has got 40 pans of scallops going. It's brutal.
I'm stressed just listening to that. It's remarkable what you do. And I know you're the culinary director at Lollapalooza. We're going to talk about that and some of the other projects you're involved with. But we've got Kim Gordon's news coming up in 2 minutes here on WGN. Show with me, Anna DeBlantis. Pro's back tomorrow, and Chef Graham Elliott is here in studio with us. You know him, you love him. He's a celebrity chef, he's a TV chef, he's a Michelin star restaurant guy. He's got all kinds of awards and accolades, and he's one heck of a good guy. But one of the things I love about you, beyond all of your awards and the fact that you're a culinary director for the Lollapalooza, and you've got something with Major League Baseball now where you're doing some stuff for them, it's like you are somebody who loves and appreciates our city, and I feel like you are one of those people that just like gets involved in everything and gets to see everything. You see the parades, I've seen you at the festivals. It's just, you're living life.
Thank you.
You're living life.
That's my favorite title would just be Chicagoan.
Chicago.
It's the best.
It's just,
it really
there's so
is.
Much to absorb in this city. And I feel like you could also lead the architectural tour. Our studio here, many people don't know that a lot of people do, but we overlook this beautiful view of Navy Pier and the Chicago River. And it is just glorious. And you're like, well, I have a fun fact for you. How deep is the Chicago River?
Yes. Exactly. And then you can say, like, over here you have the Mather Tower. And he was actually going to build two of them, but during the Depression, they left it with one. That's like my favorite building. It's over here. It's just one tiny little white spire.
So you're an architecture buff, too?
No, not at all.
Just a Chicago buff.
Like, I know, I love the fact that you have, the IBM building next to Marina Towers, because it's two different philosophies, right?
Uh-huh.
You have one where it's just about function and form, so it's a black rectangle, right?
Yes.
And 90 degree angles. And then next to it, it's a circular building because there's no 90 degree angles found in nature. So the idea was, let's build something that's that shape. And it's like two totally different contrasting styles.
You should dress up in some kind of costume and just sort of bleed one of them and see if anyone notices.
Just,
I think you could really
just
do that.
Be a giant building for Halloween.
As a docent.
Your mom doesn't have time to build something, it's like, throw on this cardboard box.
Just put windows on it, honey. It's fine.
Yeah.
All right. We'll work with it.
Mom.
This is a special time of day, and it is time right now for...
It's the top five on the Rokan Show.
Five.
Let's go.
Four, three, two, one.
Now, it's the top five at five on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
Okay, you don't need to ask twice. Georgia Engel, who played the soft-spoken and innocent Georgette Franklin on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, She has died. She landed a guest role on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but soon captured the hearts of both the audience and her fellow cast members and continued to appear on that show as the girlfriend and later wife of TV newsman Ted Baxter, who can forget him, played by Ted Knight.
Number five.
Are you sure all Rhoda would do is just listen?
Well, I guess about here is where Rhoda would have made a joke, you know, to sort of relieve the tension.
I'm sorry, I'm not very good at jokes.
That's okay, I guess I'm just really tense about tomorrow.
This priest is playing golf with this rabbi.
You don't have to do this.
I know another one about a fat lady and a duck.
No, it's just...
Her sweet voice, right? That you just remember.
Absolutely. And Mary Tyler Moore is the coolest, by the
way. Oh, so cool. Ted Baxter, you know, he was before his time, before Anchorman was even around. He was it.
Ted Knight, right? I mean, just think of Caddyshack.
We have a clip from Ted Knight? No, we don't. Okay. She also played Pat McDougal on Everybody Loves Raymond.
You know, sometimes I feel a little jealous of Hank's work.
He's a high school principal.
Vice principal, but you'd think he was the principal the way he always comes home with such interesting stories. And I just want to say, my gosh, what I would give to be a fly on the wall of that teacher's lounge. Excuse my language.
It's okay. I like how you talk.
She's one of those people, there's no way, no how she was a mean person in real life. I mean, right. She just had that sweetness about her that just, there was no way you could act that. It was just, right. It was
the female version lovely. Of Tom Skilling, as
yes.
We've been saying.
Yes, she's like Tom Skilling. Georgia Engel was 70 years old. Checking in at...
Number four.
Former First Lady Michelle Obama took a dig at President Trump during an event in London while talking to Stephen Colbert. She said that life under Trump was kind of like living in a broken home.
We come from a broken family. We're a teenager. We're, you know, we're a little unsettled and, you know, having good parents, you know, is tough. You know, sometimes you spend weekends with divorced dad and that feels like it's fun, but then you get sick. That's what America's going through. We're kind of living with divorced dad right now.
It's a motherly way of explaining things, I suppose. And I'm sure that a lot of people have different political views on what she said there. Interesting, Michelle Obama was in Paris when Notre Dame fire was going on. She was wow. on a boat, I guess like sort of a dinner cruise kind of thing. And, you know, they were having a nice time and whatever, enjoying Paris. So she must be, you know, in Europe for her book tour and things mm-hmm. like that. When suddenly it happened, everybody started looking at their phones and figured out
wow.
the proximity they had to something so terrible happening. But there she is, checking in at
number three.
Showtime has released the first official trailer for The Loudest Voice, the upcoming series that will explore the rise and fall of former Fox News chief Roger Ailes. The drama, based on Gabriel Sherman's book of the same name, will look at how Ailes turned Fox into a media giant which shaped the course of American politics. The series will also focus on the sexual harassment scandals that forced Ailes' ouster from the network. In one portion of the trailer, Ailes, portrayed by Russell Crowe, can be seen groping Gretchen Carlson, played by Naomi Watts.
Here in America, television news is king. We're going to give them a vision of the world the way they want it to be. We're way past politics. It's war.
And bring back fairness and balance.
We're gonna win.
Ooh. If you see Russell Crowe, I mean, strikingly, just looks exactly like him for this movie.
That's gonna be interesting,
doesn't
for
it?
Sure.
It's just, I mean, you think about the impact he had.
It's changed the course of history.
Right?
I mean, it really did. I mean, that's why we're where we are today.
In
for
politics.
Better or worse. You know what I mean? It's giving a voice to people that maybe weren't heard before.
And in broadcasting, just having the most watched news.
That's what I mean, right? I mean,
you know,
look
like
at
this cable station that
yeah,
is just...
The Ingram angle and Hannity. I mean,
right.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson now, right? O'Reilly's gone, and then people think something's going to happen, and nope.
No.
Numbers go up.
They still have captured...
Absolutely.
Number one spot in the cable news ratings, mm-hmm. even after Roger Ailes is gone. I'm interested in seeing that, for sure. It yep. seems fascinating. Russell Crowe, wow. Checking in at...
Number two.
A Wisconsin man who claims to have never placed a bet on sports before... says he risked $85,000. We know this guy, right? On Tiger Woods winning the Masters. And then he won $1 million, $1.15 million. James Aducci was presented with the check for more than $1.2 million at a sports book event in Las Vegas. Aducci's win represents the largest golf payout ever for a sports book or sports book operator William Hill. Aducci's reason for betting thousands with 14-1 odds?
Just him winning his first major in front of his kids. I just felt that he's going to put something together that we've never seen before, because he's got something that he's never done before, which is his kids seeing him win in person a major tournament. I just felt right.
Was there ever a time in the tournament where you were like, uh-oh, I don't think this is going to happen?
You mean all the way up until the end? Like, where I thought he might miss the putt from... No, I just being down by three and then, you know, Tiger Woods doing Tiger Woods things where guys start falling apart. I mean, it was a roller coaster. It was a roller coaster the whole time.
Anyone waiting for more to come out with the story?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is a little more. It's funny you should ask, Kevin Powell, sort of digging in the dirt there. A man with a mortgage on his house, two student loans, and two car loans decided he would take $85,000 out. That's a lot to lose in that situation.
I mean, I don't really know what's going to come out, but it's just, you sort of scratch your head at the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's not filling out the details right for you?
I mean, look, you've made the bet, you had the money, but this just feels like there's something more.
Agreed. Like somehow there's some planning behind it, like it's going to turn into a TV movie.
Not like, even like so much that anything like sketchy went on with the actual golfing part of it, but like,
no,
how did you get the money? How did you decide to do this? What did you know? What was the inside information?
Yeah, you can't switch the fact that Tiger won, but the story.
There's just something more.
85 grand turning into this.
It's like lucky number 11 up in here. You've seen that movie, that's what this feels like.
What's that movie about, Lauren? Is that... What's behind that situation?
It involves bookies and gambling. This is more horse races, not golf. But somebody that was scorned gets payback. It's a great movie. It's very complicated.
Yeah. But you're saying that something more sinister is behind this? Like there's
I just feel like there's just more to it. I don't know yet. I don't want to rush to judgment on anything. But for this guy out of nowhere to pull out 85 grand out
it
of
seems
a
like borrowed
backpack,
money. Borrowed money that...
Which isn't completely... I mean, you know, I don't know. There's just something...
I mean, the key part is, I mean, you're talking about a dude from Wisconsin getting lucky. I mean, come on. What are
probably
the chances?
Probably a Packers fan, too.
Yeah.
No one wishes them well.
I'm not buying it.
His first sports bet ever?
Mm-hmm.
That's just come out, too. I realize I didn't hear that before. That's his first sports bet, and he pays
$85,000? For 85 grand?
Again, see, all just too fishy.
Mm.
It worked out well for him, but if he borrowed the money from someone, don't you think they're going to come forward at some point and say...
Well, sure, there'll be finding him
be
in an empty parking lot in a bar.
Say, cement,
hey, buddy, Aducci, where you been? Where's our cut?
It's great for William Hill. They said that they lost money on the golf betting because of it, but that it's great for the sport, and it certainly has drawn a lot of attention. I didn't really know you could bet like this on golf, and I didn't know people did.
Well, he apparently had went to two other sports books that turned him away in Vegas, and he was kind of bouncing around Vegas with a bag full of $85,000, and he finally found a sports book to take it.
A bag full of money?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the key thing here is that you get a huge, say, you know, sports book operator, William Hill, U.S., so maybe they, this is some great marketing for
them.
They're
very happy about it, I think. Very, very happy.
Graham's onto something there, maybe.
Graham,
Forensic
Files, reporter,
I've been watching it
celebrity
for 20 years.
Chef. He's wearing multiple hats today. He's a docent for the architectural tour. He can do everything, this Graham Elliott. Checking in at...
Number one.
NBC4's David Ushery must have been listening to Snoop Dogg on his way into work today. Otherwise, he's got some explaining to do about this slip of the tongue on air. The New York City anchor was reporting about the dog that was rescued 135 miles off the coast of Thailand. And that's an incredible story. Did you see that cute little pooch they pulled out of the water? What David meant to say was doggy paddle, but what came out of his mouth was a bit more suggestive.
The dog in Thailand is certainly giving new meaning to the phrase doggy paddle. He was found swimming 135 miles off the shore of Thailand near an oil rig.
Workers first spotted the dog.
I know. There's no way around it. They believe he fell off a fishing trawler. He's now in good shape and on dry land with an animal protection group. One I'm sure I'll be working with very soon. More News 4 at 11 when we come back.
Couldn't get out of
you
that one.
You have to own it.
Oh, you had to. Oh. He was the cutest little dog, too. He was like an oil crew that just finds this dog in the open water. I mean, my gosh. Talk about that. What a sweet story. I'm happy that he was rescued.
Crazy.
Crazy stuff. Let's wrap this thing up.
The top five at five.
Sox are rolling out the red carpet for the Royals. Expect some fireworks tonight at 7 on WGN TV Sports.
That's Chef Graham Elliott. I love your radio voice.
Thank you.
It's really
Thank you.
Very, very good. Did you practice that in front of the mirror? It's different.
All day.
You're remarking upon it when you came in to the studio that a lot of us have these radio
voices.
Done it
with an accent, doing it with like a really deep voice.
The deep baritone pipes that we all
White
love
Sox
adore.
Rolling out the red carpet tonight.
Speaking of ballparks, you are doing something really cool with the Cubs.
Yes.
The ballpark series, they bring chefs in and you do special food. I love it when
yes,
they do that.
Yes, the chef series. So they highlight a couple local chefs that come out and take over, you know, one of the concession areas in right field. So I'll be doing that. I'm the first chef this year that's going to be doing it in June. And we'll be doing the lobster corn dog with lemon aioli. We do a Grahamwich where it's cheese curds, prosciutto, tomato jam in the
How
middle.
How did you come up with that combo? I mean, everyone
it
says it tastes so good,
know.
But you got the cheese curds and what else?
Creamy, salty, sweet,
love
acidic.
Curds.
Yeah, I mean, throw it between bread with like prosciutto and tomato. And then we've done...
they have the best cheese curds at Queenie's too, over at the with Black United Center.
United Center,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We also do pork rind nachos. So instead of tortilla
Those
chips,
will be very popular.
Yeah. So avocado, pico, this beautiful, you know, queso blanco, but on chicharrones. So
another thing,
nice,
I know you're a big
healthy
fan of baseball. Are you just how far food has come at ballparks? I mean, you travel. You've been to how many? Did you say how many?
I've been
stadiums?
To 27 to 30 parks now, and I did a show with MLB where it was the Grub Tour, and we went and highlighted food at different stadiums and ballparks. So it's amazing to see just in the last few years how that's evolved for the better. It used to just be, you know, bun with a hot dog in it for $50. Now you're seeing some really great offerings.
I find people in the concourse will seek out like they'll walk a great distance to get to the good food, the great food. And when the chef series that they do at the Cubbies and the White Sox food is very good too.
Oh, White Sox, Comiskey. I call it Comiskey still. I think you know, they
Sears
they do,
Tower, Comiskey.
Of course,
I get
you
it.
Have to. But I mean, they do great stuff. They have awesome food. And I think that you're seeing the same thing, like you mentioned Lollapalooza, like different music festivals, not just offering the same junk.
And you are also at the Lollapalooza culinary director.
Yeah.
So you have to cook for all
headliners
the...
and
oh,
then...
you cook for the bands
yeah.
as well?
Yep.
Okay.
And then we serve 30,000 lobster corn dogs over the weekend and help all the other booths and chefs and restaurants that are offering stuff. We try to help get them together and up to speed on what to expect.
And you'll be doing that this year as well, this year's Lala. Awesome stuff. All right, this is the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlanta. Chef Graham Elliott is joining us. We are here till 6:30, and then the White Sox play. Let's check in with Kim Gordon in 2 minutes and hear what's happening in the news. Me, Anna DeBlantis. Chef Graham Elliott is here, and he's like, you're quite the musical guy. Like, you are able to call out every single song. I know you're huge into music. Certain styles or certain genres you like?
I love everything. Like, I recently went down to Graceland and Stax and, you know, Sun Records, and now I'm in a massive Elvis phase.
Very cool. So you just go through phases where you absorb.
Yeah, and then I study. So like I was really into Queen for a while and was reading, you know, Freddie Mercury biographies and studying like the Live Aid performance. So we'll see what's next.
And you go to concerts and you're the culinary director of the Lollapalooza. And I got to get back to that really quick because before we move on to this other issue, I want to, you know, you have to serve 30,000 people, is that what I heard right there? Just one entree.
100,000 people come in over, you know, for 4 days. So 400,000 people over a weekend. We do the lobster corn dog and we sell on average, you know, 8,000 a day. So yeah, around 30,000 over the weekend.
And is any of that, like, you prep it before? You're making it there on the, I mean, how does that?
Yeah, so we have them pre packaged, and then we're frying them off and cooking them to order, and it's like an army nonstop.
I can only imagine. How do you decide what people, because our music festival tastes, are they, is there something they're looking for that maybe isn't special?
This is what I've seen is the offerings. People want things that are cooler, maybe a little healthier, but it's mostly the visual because the average age now, I think, is 15 to 17.
It's really young at Lollapalooza. Yes, where it started out maybe late 20s. Now it's trending
absolutely
so young.
And people want to be able to take a picture of something. So a giant lobster corn dog on a stick in front of a Lolla symbol. Yes, that's what works.
So
really
you think
well.
That's so funny. So you think of the visual when you prepare the food.
You have to have something that looks giant and crazy.
What is the most popular? Is that it?
The lobster corn dog. Yeah,
lobster corn dog. Can't get away from that.
No.
What? Anything else that comes to mind that's super?
Hashtagged? Burgers always work really well. Ice cream. You know, a huge snow cone. You know, things again that are big, bright, colorful, sound exotic.
Well, we were talking with Dr. Jim Adams from Northwestern Medicine earlier about a lot of the things in the news, and we stumbled upon this idea of. What do you call it? Cultured meats, lab-grown meats. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any like really attractive word for it, but yeah, lab-grown meat.
It doesn't sound great.
The idea that you can grow things in a controlled environment, so steak as well as what he was mentioning, organs. You know, the fact that that's happening now. It's only a matter of time until you see it.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are environmental reasons for it. There are ethical reasons.
Yep.
Some people would back it. I think when they've polled people, I'm not sure the whole population is ready for this yet. It's just sort of like a third of adults that were polled. The Washington Post had a story about this. And about a third of adults said that, yeah, they'd take a chance on a lab-grown meat or a cultured meat, whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems... sort of sustainability reasons, those are some of the drivers here.
That's what I mean, you have to think, right, that to have meat comes from an animal. Animals need land to roam on and to feed off of. If there's X amount of people in the world that are trying to eat that, there's not enough land. There's not going to be enough, you know, ways to process that. So it will eventually go into being man-made is what I feel. And so it's the same way, you know, if you're on a waiting list for a new liver for months and months and you hope that somehow it matches and it works versus being able to, you know, pick which one from the deli counter at the hospital. I think that's what you're going to be seeing, stuff like that. And as you mentioned, you know, getting into the ethical part, we're not out hunting for our food anymore. You know, we're not using bow and arrows to catch, you know, a giant bison and cook it. So have we evolved to the point where we don't need to eat meat? And is it, if you're a vegetarian, the fact that it doesn't have a face, you know, and it's just a grouping of cells and protein that you're eating, does it make it better? Are you okay eating that now as a vegetarian?
Well, it's interesting because I saw actually Crain's Chicago Business has an article, I think, today on this very thing. There is a push. It's a food campaign. Let's call it what it is. Mm-hmm. It's an advocacy type of person behind it. I wrote what essentially was an op-ed piece about trying to push McDonald's to pay attention to climate change and think about a plant-based option between sesame seed buns and like come up with something that isn't a side dish or just kind of, you know, iceberg lettuce and a crouton and like come up with something that's actually an entree that's plant-based. And you are seeing that at Burger King made a big splash recently because they're testing out that vegetarian burger.
And Umami Burger was one of the first to start, right? And they had the Impossible Burger and, you know, these plant-based burgers that sometimes taste better than a regular burger. So it's, again, if I just served you one versus the other, would you know the difference? Would you choose? If you know that it's healthy and sustainable and it is plant-based, do you go with that now instead? I mean, for me, it's always about taste and also...
How does it taste?
Yeah, and then the story behind it and where it's from. But a lot of times, you also have to think things that are plant-based have to be done with the same amount of love and care and long-term thought because if it's not grown... correctly, if
you
there's
can still
pesticides,
genetically modify
and
if it's pesticides and
runoffs everywhere into the water sources, there's that same idea. You know, it can be bad. whether it's an animal or a vegetable.
Well, and they say you take the cells from a live animal, the, mm-hmm. or the muscle, and then they can actually grow it in like cookie cutters so that it comes out looking just like a chicken nugget or right. a burger from the lab, essentially. Mm-hmm. My mind doesn't quite wrap around this yet, but it does seem like it's something that in the future maybe right. we'll take
for granted. Soy green, right? I mean, it's yeah. it's basically going to be like this weird man-made food. And, right. But if you're thinking about food as sustainability, I mean, think of a block of tofu. It'd be the same thing, but it would be animal-based instead of plant-based. You wouldn't know any difference. It would just be a block of protein.
Right. It tastes too spongy for me, the tofu, though.
Tofu? Right? Really? I love tofu.
You do? Yeah, I know do. It's a high really protein do. Content and that kind of thing, but it's very spongy.
I did a tofu caprese the other day. Instead of mozzarella, it was a tomato, basil, great olive oil, cracked pepper, a little balsamic, but it was just sliced tofu, like the really silken soft type, and it worked fine. Great.
Great thing about tofu is it absorbs whatever flavor you put in it, right?
100%.
So that's why it can taste good. It's just mm-hmm. you got to get past the texture. The Beyond Burger, that's something interesting because mm-hmm. I remember it was creating such a splash a couple of years ago when they released the first version, mm-hmm. then it bled because it had beet juice in it, and so right. it looked in like kind of like a real burger,
right.
but people got freaked out by that.
Yeah, because if you're vegetarian, you don't want to eat things that have blood in them, right? So
yeah, so yeah. that didn't. Then they have a version like a 2.0 version of that now.
Yes.
So that's sort of evolving. But that's one of those that I know there's some hot restaurant here that started serving it and everybody was flocking to go get it. Mm-hmm. And you're right. People couldn't tell the difference
right.
between a real burger and they just thought it was incredible.
I think so many people would get, the word vegan vegetarian, I think, has a negative connotation. If you just said plant-based, you know, maybe people like that more. But if there were more options out there for people to choose from, not just at a restaurant, but, you know, if you went to a fast food place and half the menu was healthier and vegetable option, I think people would go for it.
You it's think just, it would?
I do.
I think we're big meat eaters here, and it's part of the culture.
Yeah, but at the same time, we're the biggest restaurant city in the country because there's so many foodies. So if you went to, you know, Gibson's and they had all these steaks, but then they had these really incredible, gorgeous vegetables that weren't just a side dish, but it was like, you know, we've got the world's greatest carrot that we've roasted and glazed and, you know, seasoned with X, Y, and Z with this kind of herbs and these, you know, this roasted garlic paste. Like, people would probably want to try it. I don't know. I can't
picture it. I just can't. It's
really?
Just funny. Well, we can't picture Gibson's, I think, with that kind of thing. But you're right.
Put a bone in it. Put a giant bone and then everyone will love it.
Or put it on a stick like you do at Lollapalooza and
totally.
Everybody loves it. You mentioned another word before that's kind of a trend or is definitely a trend for many years now. Sustainable. We're trying to find sustainable proteins globally, but certainly in America, mm-hmm. we're large consumers and people are trying to be conscious about what they're eating. Mm-hmm. Sustainable. Are we doing a good job with that, Graham?
I think that we are. I think that people want to. I think that they just need to know more about it, right? You hear the word organic, and you think that that means that it's better. But a mm-hmm. lot of times that there's government rules that literally say you can't use this or you have to use that, and then it's organic. So big companies can come in and do the same thing. It's not going to be the same product as if you go, you know, to the Green City Market and meet the farmer and know the story and where it's coming from and, you know, that you're supporting somebody that has the same passion for food that you do and you're cooking it and that it's beautiful and fresh and they just picked it. I mean, that's more of a sustainable model. You know, if you keep it smaller, keep it local, kind of like politics.
I know at the Shedd Aquarium, I've done some stories with them in the past. They mm-hmm. they issue sustainable seafood charts. So if you want
right.
to try to eat the kinds of seafoods that are, you know, harvested in a sustainable way, whether mm-hmm. that's farmed or caught wild in the ocean, that they, you know, talk about the kinds of things you can eat that if you want to try to be responsible
right.
about that sort of thing, because so many of the fish, there's a bycatch issue, there's an
exactly.
overfishing issue, there's, I mean, you mentioned earlier, tuna. We see tuna in every
yeah.
bar and restaurant, no matter, you know, across
I mean,
the
gas
city.
Stations and, you know, you don't want to say the store names, but they're on every corner.
Sure.
You can go and get them in the little grocery, you know, open up the cooler and there's
And how is that possible
rolls.
That there's tuna in every single
it
place
be
all
in,
over
in a
the
couple
world?
Of years. That's the thing is also supply and demand, right? If you want tuna, 10 years ago in a restaurant, it was $8 a pound. Now it's like 17 or 18 a pound. So it's going to continuously get more and more and more expensive. Same thing with steak. A filet mignon at a restaurant is going to cost this. Yeah. You're going to start using shoulder cuts and tri-tips and all these other kind of esoteric things that are a lot cheaper because you have to. So people better start enjoying the taste of sardines, anchovies, you know,
those are
catfish, things that are quote-unquote bycatch because you're not going to have an option to have these other things.
Oh, or it'll be so expensive at
some
point.
That's what I mean.
There's nothing left.
Right.
But or the farming seafood, I guess they're having a lot of success with that. Do you see a lot of restaurants turning to farmed seafood?
Absolutely. And it's partly because of sustainability, but also just because of the economics.
And you know what you're getting, exactly. Wouldn't you be if you get to have a relationship with the person, who the vendor?
The fish purveyor, generally, you will learn that farm-raised salmon, you know, a lot of times they're raised in a little pen and they're given, you know, beta carotene at the last few days of their diet so that they turn orange. Like, it's not a great product. But then there's Scottish salmon, Icelandic salmon, where they'll literally have them way out in the ocean in larger netted areas so that the water's, you know, flushing everything through. And it's almost like a wild salmon that's being raised. So it is a consistent product. It's delicious.
Wow.
And, you know, it's done the right way.
But they're white, you said, until the last couple of weeks, isn't that?
Yeah, for some of the farm-raised ones. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like you have an aquarium of just fish that you turn a magic color and now they're salmon.
In the last couple of weeks, they just sort of pink them up and then send them out to the restaurants.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds lovely. I know we want to talk also.
So know where your food's coming from.
No, well, that's exactly what I want to talk about after the break here, because I feel like there's been a shift in dining attitudes where now we go to restaurants and when we dine out and we ask a lot of questions about the food, where it's from, what's in it, you know, and there are answers. Like, restaurants provide answers to those kinds of things, and it's kind of expected now. Let's talk about that with Chef Graham Elliott here on The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis, after we get an update from Kim Gordon about what's coming up top of the hour in the news.
Anna, the results of a new study may have a lot of men grabbing a razor.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Kim Gordon from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Ro's back tomorrow. Chef Graham Elliott is here in studio. We've been having some fascinating and very educational conversations about the world, the culinary world that you have lived in for your lifetime. And it's just interesting because we're talking about sustainable foods and growing meat in labs, and those are some of the trends out there. But I also feel like there's been a shift generationally where people now, I remember growing up, you didn't ask your server, now where did this fish come from, and how is it sourced, and you know, tell me about this, and what's the topping, and what you sprinkle on the top. I mean, like, you can ask detailed stuff about everything on your plate, and I feel like servers have a huge tolerance for this. Are they secretly going in the back and making fun of us?
Oh, always. I mean, it doesn't matter even if you don't ask those questions. We always make fun of the guests no matter what.
You got to get through the day.
Yeah. I just think of Portlandia and the skit where they're, you know, talking about the chicken. They want to see the papers and if it had friends and was it raised emotionally. Oh. Can they go visit the farm it was on? You know, and I think that it does kind of get out of hand, but it's awesome to have a captive audience. You know, just like if you were playing music, you don't want to just play it and have people, you know, kind of clap at the end. You want them to sing along and ask, you know, what was the idea behind the song and what inspired you. So when someone says, where's that vegetable from, or, you know, how did you cook that, or what, you know, I taste something, is it X, Y, and Z? Like, it's the chef's role to do that and then inspire the team in the front of the house to get that info and want to share it with the guest.
It's got to be there's got to be so much training night to night just about exactly what's on the menu and to know the answers to this place, because people ask them, don't they? I mean, they really do.
Totally. And, you know, the thing is that you should have people that are passionate about it, like, as or more so than the guest, right? The server should be. So you need to make sure that you are meeting every day saying, this is what we got in. It's really warm out today. You know, it changed as far as the temp goes. So we're going to, you know, saute it instead of braise it tonight. Oh. And here's the, you know, the reason, et cetera, et cetera. And they can then sell that idea to the guest.
I'm even amazed when I go to, like, the neighborhood bar, pub type places, bar restaurants, and the servers and the bartenders, they all will know the wines. They'll know something about the wine. They'll know where it came from. They'll know the food. Even in places like that, it feels like, is it expected?
I think it is. And I think that it just shows that everybody's excited about food. You know, the idea of just, I'm going to order this and then get it to my table with minimum interaction, it doesn't fly anymore. And nobody wants that. I wouldn't want to have a job where I clocked in and just brought food to a table.
Right.
You know, I want people to ask what it's all about. And as a guest, when I go out to eat, I want the same info.
Yeah, you've run some fancy restaurants too, and they're always down to earth, and that's one of the things I think people love and appreciate about you, that it's approachable, but it's really, it surprises you in really fun ways.
When you think about stripping things down, do you need fancy tablecloths and silver and 20 different forks and knives on the table? And, you know, no, you need like a plate and some silverware and great tasty food with fun music, and that's it.
It's simple, but when it's done well, oh my gosh, it's the best. Because I remember if you went to a white tablecloth restaurant, you would never, ever ask. I mean, you just wouldn't. You might send it back if something was horrible about it, but you just wouldn't. You just assume this was done the way it is,
and you don't ask questions. Right.
And the server did you grow up that way, or were you just so interested in food that you had to ask a
ton? Yeah, I've always been interested. And, you know, I want to go back in the kitchen and see what's going on and try the weirdest thing. That's how I grew up. You know, if there was, you know, something really bizarre on the menu, I was going to order it.
Even as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That's what I mean. Like,
it's remarkable.
When I see people that only eat steak and potatoes, you know, it's heartbreaking because there's so many cool things out there.
Ugh, there totally are. All right, Chef Graham Elliott continues with us here on WGN until 6:30. Then we have the White Sox, and we also have coming up, we're talking about the West Loop and the explosion of that dining entertainment mecca that has used to be the meatpacking area, speaking earlier about meats, and what's going on there. A lot of new stuff to talk about with the president of the West Central Association in the West Loop. That's coming up after Kim Gordon's news in 2 minutes. It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeVlantis. Chef Graham Elliott is here in studio with us today. We're so happy you were able to join us, and thank you for devoting your time. I know you've
got
a lot of things you're involved with, but we're so happy to get to talk to you. Rose back tomorrow, and you know what you were saying, it's just the weather's starting to warm up. You can almost taste the festival season here in Chicago, the farmer's markets, all that kind of thing. I just love, love, love this time.
So what do you think of when you think of spring with ingredients?
Oh, gosh. Top three. I think of like...
I'll throw out asparagus. That's the one.
Asparagus? Yeah, I'm not crazy about asparagus.
All right, what else?
I like the fruits, like the, you know, like the peaches, the watermelons, the things like that that just remind me of like being a kid and eating in the summertime.
Fun stuff.
But I'm excited about farmers markets and and much, much more. We want to talk about a neighborhood that you and I are both familiar with, Graham. It's the West Loop Fulton Market area. And if you haven't been there in a while, there's a lot to check out. It has quickly evolved into a food entertainment mecca. There's so much going on there. And even if you've been there in a few months, there are new things to check out. You've been there if it's been a while, or maybe since it was a meatpacking area and that kind of thing, you haven't really checked much out. So we are talking with Armando Chacon. He's the president of the West Central Association. Hey, Armando, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Anna. Pleasure to be on.
We keep reading about it. It's just, you know, it's sort of the darling of all the media here. Every new restaurant, there are two new hotels. There's the Hoxton Hotel, Nobu, the you know, famous restaurant is building a hotel around it. You've got lots of celebrities involved in that after the Soho House, and then just so many restaurants. Then there's an offering for everybody, but a lot of them get a ton of attention, a lot going on there. And you are front and center in the middle of all that. Armando, what can you tell people who haven't been in the neighborhood for a while?
Well, it's just an exciting and dynamic place to be. You know, obviously the neighborhood has garnered a national praise and a reputation for having the best restaurants. But there is now so much life and so much going on. There's so much just fun to be had in the neighborhood. You know, beyond the restaurants, it's just an exciting place to live. I've been here for a long time. It's just whether you're in the suburbs or in the city, another neighborhood, where you work here. I mean, again, I invite everybody to come. You will have a great time. You'll probably have the best meal that you've had in a while, and have a lot to talk about.
It's stunning to see in what's such a short time what's happened there, because I mean, I moved in there about, it's my neighborhood, full disclosure. I've lived there, what, nine, almost 10 years. And back then, it still was more of a mix of meatpacking versus just in that period of time, more meatpacking than hotspots. I mean, there were a few things there. I know you've been there, Graham, and it popped up slowly, and then it seemed like it exploded. You saw the Fulton Cold Storage building that's right there in the center, that big dilapidated building that suddenly was sold and became the Google's Midwest headquarters. And now you see technology companies moving in there. You see Dyson and Glassdoor. You've got, McDonald's famously just moved to the neighborhood. So you have that whole element and that vibrancy of seeing people work there and also play there. And now, you see people coming from the suburbs, the Midwest. The New York Times did an article about how it's a food tourism destination, even, that people are coming there from New York to test out the things that are going on there in the restaurants. It's remarkable. Have you seen that too, Armando? Are you looking around and seeing what's happening to your neighborhood? Because I know you were there for a long time, and you have an interesting story too, because your dad was a butcher back in the day.
He was one of the white coats, and I remember very clearly as a kid. He walked me down there, and I remember back in the day when you had to pick up your check every other Friday. And I go down there with him. And
do you remember the smell?
I do remember the smell. I remember the carcasses hanging because we'd have to go inside. And I just think, Dad, you work here. It's been great. I mean, I think the transformation has been nothing short of remarkable. And it's happened. It's happened in phases.
Yeah.
This journey that to get us where we are today, there's a lot of things that had to happen. There's a lot of people that had to have the faith. We had to have some pioneers that came here that came for different reasons. You had some businesses that came here. Some of them have survived. Some of them have not. But we needed them to come here. And most recently, yes, it does seem as though we've had sort of a point of critical mass. But there's still a lot of runway left here. I mean, there's still some parts of the neighborhood that have room for growth. There's some parts on Randolph that I think need some infill. If you're out on just pick any day of the week. My wife was out on Saturday night with her friends and family, and she came home and said, Armando, there were so many people out. It was just so lively. And I just eat that up. I mean, I love it. I love living here. I love having a business here. And I've loved, coming along for the ride.
Yeah. I mean, you see, like you say, it's not just the hotels and restaurants. It's all the other offerings, too. There's like arcade bars. There's bowling. There's a Brooklyn Boulder, the climbing facility. There's just so much going on in that one little spot where you never would have thought to really go. I guess there were some restaurants. There was like Marche and some other things back in the day. Light. Red Light, remember those kinds of things. And sort of,
I remember that one well.
Yeah. You do. I know. And then you had the nightclubs back there, too. There were sort of sneak places and kind of fun warehouse district-y type of places. But if you haven't seen it in a while, it's really, really, it's filling in. It's incredible. And the Taste of Randolph Street, 23 years running. That's coming up as one of the first festivals in mid-June. Do you have any involvement with that, Armando?
I'm sorry, were you asking Graham or myself?
No, you, Armando. I just wonder if you had any involvement with that, or I imagine you've been going to it for many years.
I don't think I've missed one, actually. I've gone every year. It is my favorite street festival, and obviously there's a lot to compete with. But it is certainly one of the best. I mean, I think it's more and more attended each and every year, and it's just been great to see. I have not. I've been involved with it on a limited basis, so I give credit to the organizers that started the Taste of Randolph, have done a pretty good job at running it ever since. It's certainly one of the best festivals in the city. Again, it's my favorite.
Right, and there's a lot to taste there on the Taste of Randolph time and throughout the year there, so check it out. Armando Chacon, thank you so much for joining us, president of the West Central Association, and get over to the West Loop if you'd like to have a fun night out. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Armando.
Thank you.
We're going to check in with Kim Gordon now, see what's coming up, bottom of the hour, in the WGN News.
And the FBI looking for a teen who made a threat against schools in the Denver area, including Columbine.
They're rolling out the red carpet for the Royals. Expect some fireworks tonight at 7 on WGN TV Sports.
It's the Rokan Show with me, Anna DeBlantis. We have celebrity chef with us, Graham Elliott. You know him, you love him. You have so many TV shows it's hard to keep track of. It's Top Chef, The Master Chef, The Master Chef Junior. You've got a food fight thing coming up in June.
Yes, that is correct.
Where is the Food Fight one again? It's on...
Family Food Fight on ABC.
Food Fight. That one sounds so fun, by the way.
It's awesome because, yeah, you see Aisha Curry, Kat Kaur, and I, you know, showing off families of three. So you've got, you know, a Latin background, Middle Eastern going against a family, you know, that's got a Korean history, and then... They're all fighting, and at the end, you have the best family of home cooks.
So you get to taste the food, and you grade them on the food?
Yeah, you grade them on creativity, the food, the presentation. And what's really cool is that the other families get to see and try some of the stuff, too. So there's no favoritism, you know, that they know whose food is the best.
I love it.
It's
really
cool.
There is no end to how many food shows. I would watch them all, too. They're so enjoyable. I can't put my finger on exactly what it is, because I don't really... do the recipes after or anything like that. I just love watching people prepare food.
It's something that we all do, right? I mean, whether you cook or not, everybody eats. And so you learn, you're excited, you like to check out this stuff. And I think the kids ones are
I love the kids
magical.
Ones. How are these kids at that age able to cook what they cook?
I know.
But I watch my little girl and her friends, they all watch these shows. They all do. They watch the British Bake Off. They watch the MasterChef Juniors. Yeah. They see all these shows and they just think they're fabulous.
Yeah, we cook a lot at home. My wife, Allie, and then Conrad and Jedediah, they are always making different things in the kitchen. And my two boys actually just... started working with Great Wolf Lodge on redoing a kids menu with
Get
some other
out.
Chefs. So they're
How
part of like a kids
that?
Chef council to redo children's menus.
Because
so.
Kids know what they like.
Exactly. It's not okay to just have, you know,
PB&J and the nuggets.
Parmesan and nuggets, exactly.
Well, what are the new kind of offerings? Not that they're going to put on the menu, but like what are kids in general
like
kind of
your
moving
own,
toward?
You know, yogurt parfaits with different fruits and things that you can, you know, kind of layer and set up. You've got, different steaks and build your own s'mores for desserts.
Like yum.
Things that are really fun that will get kids excited about trying new things.
So what's your kids, do they cook you breakfast in the morning and stuff?
No,
like that?
No. They I think really enjoy working with things that are, you know, baked, like desserts, cookies.
Yeah.
They do with their mom. And sometimes when I do breakfast or get to cook things like, you know, fish and things, they love to see the beginning to end process.
Is there a pressure having you as a dad when they're like trying to like cook or anything?
No,
or, like,
I don't think so. Yeah, you come home and take the white glasses off and you're just another, you know, schmo dad that sits on the couch.
They don't tell you. I can't see you as a schmo dad or even really sitting on the couch. You seem like you're so busy and have so much going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of travel. You know, a lot of times where you have to be on and you don't get a lot of downtime. But I think it's important that, you know, when you do, you try to take advantage of
it. You
love
it, though. I can tell. I mean, it just, you seem the passion comes through with you and your affability, just like how friendly you are about it. It becomes so approachable even when you're doing things that I would have no idea how to recreate in a kitchen. When you do it, it just feels so friendly and I love it.
Oh,
I love
thanks.
It. You're really incredible. So thank you, Chef
thank
Graham.
You.
We were also talking about Pete Buttigieg. Did
Good
I say
job.
It anywhere near
there
close?
Yes.
It is the hardest name, and you can't look at it when you try to pronounce it,
right.
the mayor of South Bend, because if you look at it, there's too much going on there in the name. But I'm sure he seems like somebody who we're all going to know his name pretty soon.
I
mean,
agree.
Like everyone's going to be pronouncing it. It's kind of like Blagojevich, although that went a different way.
I'm reading his autobiography right now. It's really, really cool. Great story. And I mean, the fact that the guy's 37... You know, and has been a mayor and served in the military and went to, you know, was a Rhodes Scholar, Harvard. It's
how did he do all that? And he plays classical piano, speaks
six languages. I'm reading about how he's studying Arabic and just decided to learn the language. And yeah, it's really amazing. Whether or not he goes all the way, the fact that he has decided to take his skill set and apply it to the public, you know, good is really cool.
He seems like one of the early favorites. He certainly
out of nowhere.
When's the last time
you heard of Beto?
That's true.
Like,
he sort of supplanted some of the other people who seem like the darlings of the. There's so many in the race, so that's part of the problem. But there is actually Natasha Kareki, formerly of the Sun Times. She's at Politico. She's tweeting out video of a rally in Des Moines right now, a very important place, an important state.
Right.
And she says, if there's any doubt he's having his moment, the mayor is here with this Des Moines crowd, and there's a video span mm-hmm. pans over to show it looks like several thousand people there, maybe so hundreds for sure, but definite interest in yeah. hearing what this guy has to say.
Yep.
As you're reading his book, you get more impressed,
absolutely. And I heard him on the radio maybe a year and a half ago and wrote the name down. It was just like, wow, this is amazing what he did to South Bend, you know, and his passion and his ideas behind things. And looking at him run now, I think it's really exciting. I think people are flocking to, mm-hmm. to his message.
Mm-hmm. He's positive.
He's a very positive
That's
person.
That's what
and
comes
he's
through.
Not, he's not trying to trash, you know, Trump voters, and he's trying to stay a little more on the I want everybody to win, you know, this is what my vision is and how we're going to get there. And I think people respond to that a lot more than just, you know, people that are maybe way, way, way to the left that, you know, you turn off a lot of
right
regular good old Americans.
Right. And you need to have a broader tent of voters in order to and also just to appeal to all of America.
Mm-hmm.
Butte Edge. Butte Edge is, I'm being corrected by
yes,
our producer.
Butte Edge.
He has signs as his rally. You pointed that out earlier, mm-hmm. Graham.
That said,
here's how to say the
yes,
name. And I'm going to stop saying it because it's not, I'm just butchering it.
Mayor
I'll practice
Pete.
That tonight. But it's just, I guess it's exciting. And it's exciting to see someone from the Midwest as well. He's got that,
yep.
he's got that going for
yeah.
him.
But our way?
Yeah,
right.
It's a couple
it
hours. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like two and a half, I would mm-hmm. say. Yeah, but when you're reading about his history, how did he come about six languages and all this? Where did this motivation come from? Do you get any sense for that?
His dad, I believe, is from Malta, and so he had a lot of travel back and forth with Europe. But then he eventually joins the military and serves in Afghanistan. And
amazing
yeah,
life
really,
story.
Really fascinating guy.
We'll see where he goes.
Mm-hmm.
We are, this is The Rokan Show with me, Anna DeBlantis. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Chef Graham Elliott, for being here with us.